Sup, freaks. This rip of RHR was brought to you by our good friends at CoinKite. They produce the Cold Card Q, my favorite hardware wallet. It's got two secure enclaves. It's got a full screen, full keyboard here. As you can see, if you're watching, if you can't watch, just imagine something that looks like a BlackBerry. It allows you to create private public key pairs offline in an AirGAT fashion. You never have to connect the Cold Card Q to an internet device. You can sign transactions and PSBTs remotely in the most secure fashion. If you're a Bitcoin Power user and you're looking for the best security, go pick up a Cold Card Q and go to coinkite.com. Find the Cold Card Q there. I think you can go to coldcard.com as well. Use the code RHR for 5% off. Step up your security. Get a Cold Card Q.
Our good friends, Parker Lewis and Dhruv Bansal, are two of the deepest thinkers in Bitcoin. While they come from very different backgrounds, they've landed on the exact same conclusion. It's Bitcoin that matters, not crypto. This masterclass lays out why 21 million is the key breakthrough, how Bitcoin, not blockchain, creates decentralization, and why everything else will be built on Bitcoin. Understand why Bitcoin works and why nothing else does. Watch the premiere at unchained.com/RHR. That's unchained.com/RHR.
This rip was brought to you by our good friends at BitKey. If you have friends, family members who are newbies, they still have their Bitcoin in the exchange, help them take the first step off the exchange. BitKey makes it very easy. It's a hardware device that has a multi-sig. You have the hardware device has a key, your mobile phone app has a key, and Block has a key in the cloud. They've designed this with trade-offs to make it very hard to lose Bitcoin. Easy to use, hard to lose. Go to bitkey.world. Use the code RHR or RHR20 at checkout to get a discount. Not sure exactly which one it is yet. Try both. Go check it out. BitKey.world. Try RHR or RHR20. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Stackwork. If you're looking for a great way to make KYC-free sats, Stackwork has bounties. Go to stackwork.ai, find their bounties page, and contribute to the bounties. You can make Bitcoin KYC-free for completing the bounties if you're a developer looking to scoop up some easy sats. Go check out the bounties, contribute to them, and stack some sats. Stackwork.ai.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Woo, doggy, it's Friday. It's a rabbit hole recap party.
Happy Friday.
Welcome. We got a double zoomer banger over here.
The Zoomer series continues.
It accelerates.
You've been on the show many times.
Yeah. Some could say too many.
Yeah, man. And we've got Zach from BPI as well. Zach, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's a bit of a full circle moment here. I feel like Rabbit Hole Recap was it's part of my early Bitcoin days. So cool to be on here and hanging out with y'all.
Well, Zach, you're getting thrown into the fire. This is going to be a big episode.
Can we start with Zach? How did you discover Rabbit Hole Recap?
It's a good question. Honestly, I think the guy who orange pilled me was a big Odell guy. Not to puff up Odell here, but
You're stroking that ego, Zach.
Yeah, he got me on RHR early. That was probably my first Bitcoin podcast, and I was class of 2020. So it's I'm maybe like a silent freak, right? Silent ride or die. Not always on the live chat, but always listening.
Love to hear it. Well, thanks for joining us. Glad to have you on.
And Ben, tell us your story. How'd you find us?
Yeah, Ben, what's your RHR story?
I found it on Twitter. It was not my first Bitcoin podcast. Noted was my. They took my cherry. But
fair enough.
You guys were like second or third. But yeah, I mean, I used to like in college, my internship, but I had nothing to do. So I would listen to old RHRs and just stare at the wall. That was grueling.
That's a great way to spend your time.
Yeah, there's nothing else to do.
What are we, Ben, do you remember? Do you remember when we met for the first time in person? Yeah,
Bitblock Boom.
In the hallway?
Yeah, yeah.
You were like 12 years old.
Fuck off. Yeah, no, we all went to In-N-Out. That was good.
In my mind, when I think back on that memory, I imagine you as a 12-year-old.
Where was the first time we recorded? Was it when I came to Austin to look at places and we did it at my Airbnb?
Yeah,
did we do one in New York too?
No, we never did one in New York. It was like me, you, and Chris at that Airbnb.
Yeah. 2021.
Yeah, something like that.
We've got a veteran here.
Marty, Zach, did you see what I named the episode?
Rabbit Hole Recap, 355 Bitcoin, $100,000 in sight while Bitcoiners fight. Rhyming for the algo. I like it.
Dude, we really fucked up. Like, we could have done 6 months of 100K in sight as our title, but missed opportunity.
Missed opportunities, right? Big big week, Zach. I said I was throwing you into the fire because, as the title of this episode alludes, there's a lot of fights going on out there right now as it pertains to Bitcoin, Bitcoin Core, and the controversy around op return and the changing of the limits or the elimination of the limits. Is that how you would describe it?
Basically.
I think you've been at the forefront of this controversy for the last few years, so I'll let you lay it up from your perspective. What's going on right now?
Yeah, I mean, this is like a 12-year-old controversy or something, like as old as me, basically. But like the op return limit was added in like 2013 or 14, something like that, and basically it was like we don't want people putting like, you know, music videos on the blockchain. That's bad. We should have it for financial transactions. So they like limited the op return limit, and that's worked for the last 10 years ish. And then like 3 years ago, Ordinal's inscription started, and turns out op return is obsolete. You can just stick unlimited data into witnesses, and it's even cheaper. So after all that, like basically like kind of like 2 years ago, like on the mailing list, people were like, well, maybe this op return limit didn't even make sense back then. Like, it's only a mempool policy. It's not a consensus rule. So it's, like, pretty trivial to get around if you just contact a miner. And so people are like, well, oh, well. But there's already enough drama around inscriptions then that are, like, let's not increase the op return limit, like, right when it happens. That's just going to cause more controversy. And so that's been, like, kind of the state for the last 2-3 years. And then earlier this week, Antoine Poisson proposed on the mailing list, we should remove the op return limit. And he said this basically because, kind of the reason they stated earlier of like, you know, inscriptions are the way to do it today, but they're more harmful to the chain. And he heard that there's some other protocols. He named Citria, who is basically
It's a ZK rollup.
Right? Yeah, it's a ZK rollup, but BitVM kind of thing, is my understanding. But basically, like one of their watchtower protocols or something, they want to op return 140 bytes or something around that magnitude, and the op return limit's 80 bytes. So instead of being able to like just op return the 140 bytes, they're doing like a 80 byte op return followed by like two tappered outputs that are unspendable, just putting in the extra data. And like that's like kind of the worst case scenario we have here, because there's like three ways to embed data into Bitcoin. It's op returns, inscriptions, or unspendable outputs. And unspendable outputs are like the actual like harmful one. I mean, they're all like not the best. Like we want Bitcoin to be, you know, financial transactions on a data storage layer. But the thing is, like when you are embedding data into unspendable outputs, these like pollute the UTXO set forever. And like that's just like going to be there forever. You can't prune it. You can't do anything.
What was the stat you shared with me? Orange Surf ran the numbers. Was like 49% of UTXOs are below 1,000 sats, right?
Yeah, yeah. Something like 49% of UTXOs are under 1,000 sats. And it was like something around like 40% of transactions in the last 2 weeks had either an inscription or an op return in them. So it's like, this is a huge thing happening today. It's like, we can LARP about filtering all we want, but it's like, it's almost a majority of Bitcoin traffic right now. So it's like, these things are happening whether we like it or not. And it's like, we can either, so like, that's kind of the way the controversy started now, where it's like, okay, let's just accept the reality that these things are happening. And like a lot of the, the mining space has like just moved to accept it. Like we have Slipstream now from Mara to accept non-standard transactions. There's Libra Relay, which is like Peter Todd's small fork of Bitcoin Core that does preferential peering to other peers to find peers that relay non-standard transactions. And then like we've seen, like there's like these private services other mining pools provide to do like 4 meg blocks with inscriptions and stuff. So it's like all these services exist. So like none of our mempool filters are stopping them. So it's like, let's just accept that fact and like have Bitcoin Core's mempool policy match reality and allow these things through. And like, this is really important for node software, because like when your mempool doesn't match what the next block is, you're going to have worse fee estimation and slower block relay. So it's like, it's only upsides there. The problem is, like, you know, it just causes drama, because when people see Bitcoin Core is lifting the upper turn limit, people say, oh, Bitcoin Core is pro ordinals or pro inscriptions. Or when they name Citria, people are like, oh, this is, they're just helping out a company, or, you know, in conflict of interest stuff. So that's basically my summary of what's happened.
I'll jump in and say, I think there's layers to this controversy, this drama. Obviously, I think we have to go back to like SegWit and Taproot, getting those implemented into the protocol, merged into the protocol. And one of the unforeseen consequences of that is the combination of those two, I believe, is the ability to do inscriptions, ordinals, all of that. And we've been very public about this on this show. I mean, I was, at least. I'll take personal responsibility, like cheerleading for Taproot with the inability to actually understand the very technical consequences that came down the line in the sense of ordinals and Taproot, ordinals and inscriptions. And for the last 2 years, when you were at Taproot Wizards, when you guys were like, we're going to sell these JPEGs, I was like, I think the best approach is just to ignore it. And it goes away. I'm not trying to be mean here, but I don't think there's a ton of real world demand for that. I think it's a lot of hype, and I think the last 2 years have proved that. There was a lot of hype out of the gate, but it ultimately died out. But then we have the whole controversy around Bitcoin Core as a software project and the sort of governance structure of how things get incorporated into the code base. And I think that's one thing this week where I think many people are questioning, like, how could one PR to remove the limit and the conversation around that PR? People are saying it was censored, mm-hmm. and then there's the Bitcoin Core side saying there's dynamics of the software project and how people contribute to it. So it's very messy.
First of all, Ride or Die Freak Brian zapped us 100,000 sats in the Nostr live chat. He said, fat zaps only, shout out me. Is Marty truly the Bitcoin Ron Burgundy and will read anything? Ow, pew, pew, bam, bam. Looking forward to listening back at 2x speed. Thank you. Thank you for your support. That is it's a fat ass zap.
Odell is the Ron Burgundy here. Thank you, Brian. That was sick.
That's the Gen Z zap, isn't it?
This is the Gen Z zap. You don't get any of that, Zach. You just get to be on the show with us. That's
okay. I'll take it.
I think Ben did a good job of explaining the technical technical context here. I think the key thing here is that you could already do this. Ben actually makes it very easy to do with his op return bot. I don't know, Ben, how much money are you making on the op return bot? Are you making a significant amount of money? I feel like you
don't feel forced to disclose that.
I mean, I made enough to pay for dinner this week, but not significant.
Logan, can you pull up the mempool link that I put in the chat? Do you have that there? It's in the list.
He's got
it. Yeah, scroll down. Scroll down. Keep scrolling. Oh no, you gotta
details.
Click expand details. So anyway, I embedded a full Nostr note, signed message, using Ben's bot. I paid about $8. I don't know what cut Ben got. And it says that if you're a Nostr contributor, you should apply to OpenSats. And this is confirmed in chain without any change to Bitcoin Core. So I think, first of all, it's important to realize that this is possible regardless of a Bitcoin core change. And I stand by that, by the way. It's a signed message. Like, you should apply to OpenSats if you are working on any alternative implementations to Bitcoin Core. This is why OpenSats exists. OpenSats exists to fund developers that might not have gotten funding otherwise through the existing core funding mechanisms. So go to opensats.org if you want to apply. I will say that we've never received an application for a Knots contributor. But we are open to it. We would love to have many alternative implementations funded through OpenSats. The second piece is, I think this is more of a governance question. And I think it's not really technical. And I think there are people that are sounding the alarm here, and that's good. I think there's a lot of exaggeration in terms of it being necessarily an emergency, particularly because of the technical question here, which is that it can happen anyway, that people can already do this stuff. In terms of governance, I think the big thing here is that it is a policy. It is a policy question. So this is something local that your node is deciding what it wants to accept into its mempool and relay. And I think fundamentally that should be up to node runners. I think we probably are past the point in Bitcoin's history where we should be having, dictates from above on how your policies should be run on your node. And I think we should probably give node runners as many options as possible in terms of how they want to handle that policy. The second piece of the governance issue is that open discussion is incredibly important. And it should be happening in ways that are easily accessible and hard to censor. I think Noster is ideal for this, but there's other options as well. And I think the way the actual PR was handled and the moderation of the PR was very alarming. I think you shouldn't be locking down these things, and you shouldn't be blocking or muting comments that are not outright spam. That you should be very, very conservative if you do at all. And I think that's where the biggest issues are here. I think the biggest issues aren't actually technical in scope. One more thing I would add here is the one thing we do have going for us in Bitcoin land is that no one has auto updates. So it's important to realize that even if an update gets shipped that you don't agree with, you have the right and capability to not update your node and seek out alternative implementations that you would like to run instead. But I think that's the important takeaway here. The important takeaway here is that it's really not a technical debate. I think it's more of a people debate and a governance debate than actual technical specifics of this pull request in question.
I completely agree, because it is a bit conflicting for me, because I agree with the idea that we should probably just get rid of the op return limit, because as you said, these transactions can happen and they are happening out of band. And I don't know if you have it on the list, but Greg Maxwell wrote a really good piece on BitcoinTalk.org, I believe yesterday, and basically highlighted this, like the risk that we run if you don't eliminate that op return limit is that you have things like Slipstream and these out of band sort of connections between people making these transactions and the largest miners that can get them included in the block. And that creates some centralization pressure at the mining layer, which we don't want. And so I believe the idea of eliminating the op return limit is, let's just allow everybody to relay these transactions so you don't have that sort of out of band centralization pressure. If it's going to exist, you should do it that way. But to your point, Matt, even though I believe the op return limit should have just been, this is happening, like, let's just recognize that this is a fact and accept it and make sure that the P2P layer of the protocol is as robust as possible. But to your point, I think the governance and the way the PR was handled specifically is a bit alarming.
Yeah, I mean, I can totally see that. I mean, there's worse comments that like have warranted being banned before. Like, I mean, like other people get banned from Bitcoin Core repo. Like, I think someone got banned last week as well. It's just like, this was like a lot more public because people went to Twitter after they got banned instead of just being like crying on the mailing list. And, but yeah, I mean, the problem is like, these are like people, like, there's like as Marty's kind of saying, like, this is technically kind of a no nonsense argument. It's just like, yeah, this makes sense. Let's just make mempool policy accept reality. And then there's like, you know, hundreds of people just diving into the comments, like spamming, like saying like, you're killing Bitcoin, or like, and the precipice before people got banned was they said like, stop attacking contributors, please only debate technical things or the actual code of this PR. And then people started like, oh, attacking contributors or saying like, oh, conflict of interest and all this stuff. Not like what they said to being the technical. So they said, okay, well, we gave them the warning. They didn't follow, so they banned them. Like, it was pretty clear cut in my opinion. I mean, it's not like a permanent ban. It's like a 7 or 30 day ban. So it's like, they'll be allowed back. And like, I'm pretty sure every person banned was not an actual contributor. They were just, you know, degens from Twitter kind of thing. So it's not like, I mean, it's not good, but it's not like, oh, you stopped Peter Wolla from like working on Cluster Mempool or something. It's like, these are people that weren't making anything to Bitcoin Core.
Well, okay, contributors can't comment on that PR right now either.
Yeah, no,
it's completely locked down.
Yeah, they just locked it. I mean, which is like, this has happened many a time. So I mean, like, I think a few years ago, Peter Todd might have opened like a similar pull request to remove the opt-turn limit, and same thing happened. They just locked the comments because it got too heated. This is like a feature in GitHub. Is like, if comments get too heated, you can lock it.
It's a very messy thing, and I don't want to neglect the other Zoomer in the room, but I do think this is a good opportunity to pull you in, Zach, because I think what you guys do at BPI, interfacing with politicians in Washington D.C., like, we're having a pretty in-depth, nerdy conversation about the governance of the open source software project that is Bitcoin. How do you guys communicate that this is how Bitcoin works to Capitol Hill?
Yeah, we're pretty far from this conversation on Capitol Hill. to put it lightly, I was just there yesterday, and you know, we spent probably like an hour getting to Capitol Hill, right? And then we go in the office, and then the guy we meet with gives us like 10 minutes, and then he pretty much kicks us out. And you know, broadly speaking, I think most of those conversations are they're trying to understand better, you know, how the U.S. government needs to kind of like look at Bitcoin, and we're so far from them actually understanding like how Bitcoin works. You know, they're like asking questions about China and like how much Bitcoin they own, and you know, questions about kind of like U.S. national security and those things. And so conversations like this about, you know, kind of you know, how the internal politics of you know, Bitcoin's consensus and those things play out, we're pretty far from that.
That's probably a good thing.
I mean
there, you know, I remember back, you know, when the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve kind of first popped up, you know, in the conversation. And one of the major concerns was, or not concerns, but topics of conversation was, you know, if the United States basically takes a large position in Bitcoin, right, they're going to start probably allocating resources towards the kind of development side and maintenance side, you know, of the protocol, given the quantity of, or, you know, the value that they have locked up. And so, you know, how does that kind of play? You know, and I don't think that conversation has gotten much further, but I think that's something that's still interesting to talk about.
What would Donald Trump say about this opt-return drama?
I don't want to know.
Remove the limits.
Yeah.
We need to remove the limits.
The biggest opt-returns. Only American opt-returns. From opt-returnbot.com.
So I don't know if we need to tie it. I think we should keep talking about this. So how do you see this, Blake? Maybe we should pull the spam filter part of the conversation into this. What is the argument there?
I mean, the argument there is like what Ocean and them are like, yeah, like we need to increase the filters. Like Knots has like extra filters in it to like say like they won't relay inscription transactions and stuff like that. Like, they even block transactions with a lock time of 21 because someone made a protocol of like, if the lock time is 21, it creates an NFT. So like they just like randomly block things basically. And it's their thing is like, if every node has this mempool filter, then we'll at least somewhat hinder inscriptions and bloat. So then Bitcoin will be better off. Thing is like, that's just not going to work. Like, you can filter at the mempool level, but we're already see tons of non-standard transactions go through all the time. So it's like, you're not going to stop it. You might increase the friction, but eventually they'll just get around that. They'll just make a more frictionless thing where they directly connect the miners, and then Bitcoin will be worse off for it, because you can no longer have like real transaction relay. The only good things mined is talking directly to the miners. And like, this is what happened in like every shitcoin. So
is there a potential that filters could actually be detrimental to the health of the P2P layer?
I mean, yeah, like when your blocks or when different nodes have different mempools, it like slows down transaction relay, it slows down block relay. It, because like when my node connects to you, I say, oh, like, we like start broadcasting transactions, but if you keep giving me transactions that I don't want, now we're wasting bandwidth. When you send me a block that has transactions I don't know about, I have to like re-download those transactions and verify them, versus if they're already in my mempool, I've already verified them and already have them. So you're saving on bandwidth and time. So like, when you don't have these in your mempool already, it's just like wasting everyone's time and bandwidth. And the thing is, like, you're not stopping them by like being the one node on the network that's not relaying them. And then you also, like, if you have an inaccurate view of the mempool, then you're also going to have worse fee estimation, which is like a critical security thing for like any layer two protocol.
Yeah. I think I'm in the camp of it's happening. There's nothing that people are going to do to stop it. I actually think there is a Streisand effect to this, where the more you like lean into screeching against it, the more, I wouldn't call them malicious actor, but the more people that enjoy a level of schadenfreude and like seeing people screech will lean into.
Yeah. Doing, I mean, like, half the Taproot Wizards marketing is like drinking maxi tears. It's like their whole thing is making everyone mad. So it's like, you're just falling into the trap. Like, if we just move on, life will be easier.
Ben, why did you leave Taproot Wizards?
Well, I joined to do cat research, but we stopped doing cat research. So I left.
Why'd you stop doing cat research?
Because they wanted to sell all their wizard NFTs. So we had to build a website for that.
Hey, everybody gets off the path every once in a while. You're back now.
Yeah, now I'm back in Spiral. Things are good. No more
NFTs. We're glad to have you at Spiral. Soap Miner zapped 21,000 sats saying, I was hoping y'all were going to talk about this. Average Gary zapped 21,000 sats saying, Bitcoin Gary's mod in 2 weeks. Thanks for the continued signal, gents. I mean, since you guys firmly stated your opinion as pro this PR, I would just say that, I mean, once again, I think that this should be...
Not pro PR, pro like... Like, we should just recognize, not like this specific PR in Bitcoin Core repository, but like the idea that we should recognize that the limit is creating these pressures to go out of band.
I mean, like, what, honestly, probably the most politically correct, or maybe not that's the right word, but most like way that it'll appease everyone is like what happened with mempool for RBF, where it was added to Bitcoin Core but default disabled. And then enough nodes and hash rate enabled it, and where it was now illogical to not have it on by default. So like, probably what, like, I tweeted this out yesterday, is like, everyone should
This is a little bit different. I mean, why can't it just be a configurable option in Bitcoin Core?
I mean, like, this is literally the only option in Bitcoin Core that where you configure mempool policy. And again, it's like, there's no real reason to have it. All it does is hurt it yourself by having it not like at the max, because you just have, you see less transactions. Like,
yeah, but like, let the user decide. Like, we already have a default. The default is 84 bytes. The user should be able to remove that default if they want to, and they should be able to do the opposite if they want to, and then it's solved. Like, if I as a node runner want to make sure that I see every transaction so I have better fee estimation, which, by the way, because there are so few Bitcoin transactions, you can just guarantee that it's 2 sats per byte for like whatever. You don't even need the fee estimation right now. If I want to have better insight in that, then I'll change the configuration. And if I don't, I do that.
I mean, I agree. Why the is thing that? Is like, I mean, defaults like are like extremely sticky, that like 99% of people do not touch their Bitcoin conf file. So like, we like Bitcoin Core as a software should provide the best experience to the user. Like, here's an accurate mempool. Like, it shouldn't like, oh, download the software. Oh, if you want an accurate mempool, you got to change all these settings. Like, that doesn't.
I mean,
make
I
sense.
I don't know if that's true any with Bitcoin Core. I mean, I don't know if that will be true going forward with Bitcoin nodes in general. Like, I Bitcoin nodes are not going to be run by grandmas. We have probably less Bitcoin node runners than listen to MSTR podcasts. Like, I feel like it's a different breed. Like the,
I mean, yeah,
like but maybe,
I
mean, like maybe the node Bitcoin software. Node software should be built for the remnants. It shouldn't be built for like the masses. I mean, you could try, but like most of them are just going to blindly just like press update on their Umbral node. Like, I don't think those people, their nodes really matter that much.
Ooh.
I mean, I tend to agree there, but it's still, it's like, you end up like screwing up like the network topology by doing that, where it's like, oh, if majority of the node, we have all these Umbral nodes with like random mempool configs because some guy like posted on Twitter his config and everyone copied it. It's like, we're just like screwing up the network and transaction relay for like, only reason is because of virtue signaling of like, oh, we're freedom maximizing our mempool config, where it's like, why don't we just do the technically sound thing of like, let's just have aggregate mempools. Like, as we stated earlier, changing your config policy in your mempool doesn't change what ends up in blocks. So it's like, why are you changing your mempool config to be inaccurate? It's purely for virtue signaling. It's like, Bitcoin Core shouldn't be like a virtue signaling software. It should be a extremely good Bitcoin node.
I mean, I don't know if it's virtue. Like, why should my node... Why should my node relay Bible verses if I don't want it to? Or like Odell's Noster notes?
Because like, why, if you don't want to relay my Noster? Block.
Okay, well, at that point, so be it. But why should a user have to do that? I mean, I think.
Tell him we'll get him when. Sorry, our next guest just came in the door. Logan, tell him we'll get him when we're ready.
Anyway, I mean, once again, I think this is a governance issue. I think it's a relatively, and I will just, I've said this many times in the past, like I appreciate every single one of our open source contributors. I think Bitcoin's built on their backs. We're very lucky to have people that are incredibly skilled and incredibly passionate about this project that are often working for free. And even if they are receiving grants, aren't receiving grants that are comparable to private sector jobs that they could be working instead. And I'm very grateful for all that. But I think this is a relatively cheap wake-up call to people that we should have, you know, node runners should have many options, and they should have options. And if Bitcoin Core doesn't want to provide those options, then other people will provide those options. And that will be what's best for Bitcoin long term.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I agree we should have more implementations. Like, yeah, it's clear there's clearly demand for other implementations. I mean, I personally wouldn't run knots. There's no one reviewing the code. It's just Luke pushing code. But I mean, that's a problem. Like, that's purely like, you know, there's clearly demand for knots. We should have more devs working on it, because just Luke pushing code is not going to be safe for the long term.
Are you live
Bitcoin? But I mean, no. And like specifically in this situation, the fear with multiple implementations have always been consensus forks, so that you'd have some kind of a fork that would happen, and we'd be at bigger risk for fork. But in this situation, it's a policy argument. Like, there's no risk of fork here. I feel like.
And Knots is a fork of Bitcoin Core, so it's the exact same code for consensus stuff.
The consensus stuff, yeah. It's just policy changes.
Oh. All right.
All right. Bring on Marks.
I'm kidding.
Thank anyway, you, I just want to say, as it stands right now, the Bitcoin blockchain is a Noster relay. So.
Well, as it stands right now, too, high priority transactions are getting through at 4 sats per vbyte. So it's a lot of kvetching for.
I feel like that's the last piece here too, as for newcomers, is for them to realize that our ultimate spam mitigation technique in Bitcoin is the fee market. The fee market is a dynamic free market. As transaction demand increases, because block space is scarce, block space is intentionally limited to help with mining distribution and node distribution. So it's lower friction and lower cost to enter, to run your own node, and also that it doesn't, you know, increase centralization of miners. So we intentionally limit block space. So block space is scarce. As transaction demand increases, so does fees. And then you have to pay more fees to get added into a block. As a result, it should make spam incredibly expensive. But as we've seen, transaction demand right now is not really that significant to the point where we're seeing a sustained high fee market. But that is the ultimate backstop. And the beauty there is it's not controlled by someone. It's not like Google setting a spam filter, which is completely centralized and prone to corruption.
Economics fixes this.
Are you going to be at Bitcoin Plus Plus next week?
Oh yeah, Bitcoin Plus Plus got 10x more fun this week, so that's gonna be fun.
I love it. That's my favorite conspiracy, that Nifty did all of this just to sell tickets to BTC Plus Plus. She's got like a debate going. She's like making hats.
She's got
shit.
Two debates.
It's genius.
And I mean, it's so if you're not planning on getting to Bitcoin Plus Plus, it's next week in Austin, Texas, and the topic of Bitcoin Plus Plus in Austin this year is mempools and mining. So
yeah,
very pertinent to the discussion we just had.
It's a good conspiracy. It's way too
a year ago she announced it's mempools and timed it perfectly with all the drama. Very proud of her.
And then the Texas Energy and Mining Summit is happening. It's like back to back, right?
Yeah, Bitcoin Plus Plus Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Texas Energy Mining Summit Tuesday, Wednesday. So I'm going to be straddling both on Wednesday.
So great time to visit Austin.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Check it's always out. A good time to be in Austin.
Hey, congrats on the gig.
Thank you.
At Spiral. I'm very happy that you're working on what you're working on now compared to what you were working on last year. So it's...
Yeah. More people were excited about me leaving Tapper Wizards than I expected. But oh, well. I guess I should have expected that.
We should. All right. Right. I won't shoot you.
See you guys.
I'll just say thank you for coming and see your way out the door, please.
Anytime. I'll grab Marks.
Okay.
Thanks, Ben.
Marks is going to join us, but Zach, we've been neglecting you in the corner here. I think while we get our next guest in the seat here in the TFTC studios at Bitcoin Park, Austin. Let's transition. A lot of things going on here. We just talked about the politics of Bitcoin at the protocol level. A lot of stuff going on at the Hill right now. I had Brian Morgenstern from Riot, who's their head of policy, on TFTC this week. And we had a discussion about the priorities on Capitol Hill right now as it pertains to digital asset legislation. And interested to get your thoughts, because I've talked to Matt Pines and I believe Zach Shapiro quote tweeted a tweet I sent out last week, but like the priority on the Hill right now seems to be stable coins, market structure, Bitcoin strategic reserve, distant third. What's your synopsis of everything that's going on right now?
Yeah, so we recorded we're doing like a weekly policy hour now, just started doing that. And this week's topic was exactly that. You know, I think kind of early days Trump admin, the SBR was top priority, right? We got the executive order in early March. And then the whole kind of tariff situation obviously happened. And, you know, I think by Liberation Day, the priorities had kind of shifted. I think broadly speaking, right, there's a divide here between the executive and the legislative branches. So the Trump admin and the executive, they're, you know, they've been very focused on Bitcoin, the strategic Bitcoin reserve, you know, Bitcoin's sort of geopolitical valence. And then on the Hill, right, there's a little bit more at play. The lobbyists have you know, been on the Hill, have been talking about market structure, which is, you know, that's broadly speaking the bill for, you know, shitcoins not to get into legal trouble, you know, unregistered securities, blah, blah, blah. And then the other one is obviously the stable coins piece. But market structure has been talked about for, you know, I think like 5+ years at this point. We've had kind of corporate lobbying divisions, government affairs people talking about market structure for that whole time. And so they're like, they see an opportunity to get that over the finish line that hasn't existed before. And so they're kind of putting the heaters on. But I think, you know, the point that we like to make at BPI is that, you know, those things are not necessarily urgent, right? Like we have 3.5, maybe almost 4 more years of the Trump admin where there's, you know, a good chance of these things kind of moving through. But, you know, if we take the kind of Bitcoin space race, you know, conversation into consideration here, you know, the SBR needs to happen first. And that's our priority on the Hill.
Yeah. Yeah, I wrote a newsletter about this last week where it's like, because I went to an event in Dallas held with a representative from Wisconsin that was hosted by the Texas Blockchain Association, and it just became clear to me there, like all the questions were about stablecoin and market structure. And I was like, why is there so much attention focused on these two bills when the profundity of a strategic reserve is so like orders of magnitude larger? Like stablecoins, yeah, they have product market fit, market structure, who cares? Like people have been spinning up shit coins and dumping them on retail for 13 years now. Stablecoins, like cool transitionary technology, but really not the long-term signal. And it just seems like, and I won't even fault the politicians on the Hill for focusing on this. It just seems like the lobbyists have really done a good job of inserting themselves and saying, we need this regulation so that we can create a regulatory moat that kicks Tether out, and we need this regulation so that we have clarity that dumping these tokens on retail is okay. It's just like, focus on something that is more profound, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's kind of like a, you know, sunk cost fallacy going on here, right? Where you've poured resources into these two bills, namely market structure and stablecoins, for however long it's been. And then, you know, the strategic Bitcoin reserve kind of pops up. I think we started talking about that in like November. And everyone's like, hey, like, who's this new guy? What are they doing here? They're trying to steal our thunder. You know, maybe we can only get one bill through, and so we want it to be ours. And, you know, I think broadly speaking, right, even if you take kind of like the most wealthy, you know, CEOs of crypto companies, right, like Brian Armstrong and, you know, the folks over at Kraken or whoever, right? If you asked the people at the top of those organizations what their legislative priority would be, I think pretty much across the board, they would tell you the strategic Bitcoin reserve. But I think there's kind of a disconnect happening between those people and their, maybe, you know, their government affairs department, who's sunk 4 years into the market structure bill. And so, yeah, again, there's kind of that divide there. But I think broadly speaking, the people who have the real kind of skin in the game here are all on the same page about this.
Yeah. Be aware. Welcome our next Zoomer, Marks.
Wait, Marks, welcome. Before we continue, I just want to give Marty a heads up. Zach's going to leave us in 15 minutes. So just FYI.
Okay.
We got a zap from Bitcoin in Space 2. He zapped us 42,000 sats. All these Zoomers are cool, but Gen X were the original people to get shit all over by the older generation. Marks, are you Gen X?
I'm one of these like straddlers. I'm the Oregon Trail generation.
What
I'm
is like, that? I've never heard that one.
So it's the people that were like 1980 and 1985, where you still remember days before the internet, but then you played Oregon Trail a ton in elementary school. And then you also are native to the internet because you were like growing up during that time. So yeah, there's like this weird thing called the Oregon Trail generation, which is between millennial and Gen X.
Yeah.
So that's me.
Marks, we were thinking of ways that he could disguise himself to look more like a Zoomer.
I shaved. I got rid of my gray beard. I do have a gray beard when I don't shave. But the chat seems to think that Zach isn't a Zoomer either. So they say that you're too wise to be a Zoomer.
No, I think they're talking about you, right?
Oh, I don't know. I thought they were talking about Zach. But yeah, maybe they're talking about me.
I mean, I do think it's funny when a Zoomer comes in a suit and he's like on Capitol Hill and shit.
Yeah. You see all the Doge guys yesterday? They're all dressed up, full suit. Looks great.
That was impressive. Did you watch that? Did you watch that?
The Washington
team? They did a, what's his name, Jesse Waters from Fox News, did an interview with the Gen Z Doge team. It was actually, they're pretty impressive individuals.
And I still love seeing big balls in like the lower third the Fox News, right? With a guy in a suit.
Yeah, big balls got interviewed. Very very smart kid. We got good Gen Z guys. We got good Zoomers. I've said this throughout the Zoomer series that we've had over the last few weeks. Thank you, Logan. We need this.
they're bored already.
Keep it up. Keep it up. There is this divide in Gen Z. In my mind, at least, as a old curmudgeon millennial, where you have like the man on the street TikTok house Zoomers, and then you have the Zoomers who are taking agency over their future and trying to do stuff. Maybe I'm being too judgmental, but.
Well, I feel like
it's like that in every generation, though.
It's true.
I feel like Gen Z gets the whole like nihilism bit kind of overplayed, right? Like, I've listened to the past couple of episodes. You know, I think this has kind of been the topic of conversation. I think my sort of take on the Gen Z, you know, who we are, I guess, is I think it's less of a nihilism and it's more of kind of growing up. Without ever like thinking that something's kind of like in your way, right? We just kind of like the bit of like you can just do things, right? I think is that's sort of like broadly correct for Gen Z. I think some of Gen Z, right? I think like Matt's right. You know, there's little bits of you know, kind of individuality in the generations, but I think right, like Gen Z, there's a lot of us who just like. Don't really care about the things that people tell you like not to do. And you know, like one thing that I do think is interesting is you know, Gen Z, I would say, is broadly more interested in crypto than they are in Bitcoin. You know, being on kind of like university campuses and those kinds of things, right? The blockchain clubs are the ones that are more popular than the Bitcoin specific clubs. So I don't know what to make of that. But I do think like,
once again, that's the same with every generation, though. Yeah. Like, objectively, there's more people that are crypto curious than are Bitcoin only.
Yep.
And across every single age cohort. I mean, maybe it'll be less the case now that Ethereum is just absolutely shitting the bed and people are losing a ton of money. But historically, that has been the case.
Hand up.
Yes,
I've been an ageist. I've been judgmental. I've been running with some assumptions. I've learned a lot during the Zoomer series, and I'm going to continue learning. I should not judge. So sorry for all the Zoomers out there. There's more of you now. I know. For Uncle Marty's judgment, pre Zoomer series, I'm learning a lot. I'm happy that we're doing this series.
Yeah, we're working on it, right?
Yeah, we're gonna win. We're all in this together. We've got Oregon Trail generation, some millennials, some Zoomers. We're blending the generations.
That's right. Someone's asking if we have an Among Us generation coming up too. So we'll start naming generations after popular games. So there you go.
Did you see, talking about video games, you see Fortnite won the big case against Apple? I think that's what we're talking about next, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why I'm here. But do we have any more for Zach before he has to bounce?
Zach, final thoughts.
It's been a pleasure. I feel like Marty was right. Kind of got thrown in the deep end here on the on the technical conversation, which is, you know, happy to listen in and but yeah, it's been fun. Final thoughts: the Bitcoin Policy Institute is holding a summit at the end of June, June 25th in DC. It's gonna be a banger. It's gonna be kind of we like to say it's the highest signal event of the year. You know, Pines got on a podcast earlier and he said, you know, this isn't like your think boy, like moon math conference. This is, you know, this is where the real policy conversation, is going on. So, yeah, we're selling tickets for that. Go to btcpolicysummit.org. You know, we're going to have about 1,000 people there. So a little bit smaller, but not super small. But you'll get some good FaceTime and some good conversations in. So highly recommend that. Before I go, quick question. Can I read Clark's dashboard? Or is that too
Oh, yes. Yes, you can. We missed it.
Yes.
Let's see. Hey,
is this a first?
Can you see it? You may have to pull it up on your own computer just to read it.
Zoomers, yeah. Zoomers keeping us honest over here.
I got it up. He's got guys. All right. Let me know if I miss anything. All right. So they are actually selling bitcoins. One bitcoin for 97,750 cuck bucks. One cuck buck is going to get you 1,023 sats. It's pretty crazy. We're at a total market cap of 1.94 trillion cuck bucks. Block height 894,916. And then the next bit here is mining. We are 100. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. We are 188 blocks to the next difficulty adjustment. Retarget date is looking like May 3rd, 2025, with an estimated difficulty adjustment of -4.5%. That's a big 4.5. One.
Dang.
It's a minor.
What do we think about that, yeah. Marty?
I think it's great. Hash price just went over 5 cents terahash per day. If we get a 5%, almost 5% downwards adjustment, that hash price is going to go up. If the price keeps ripping, this is good. Good time to be a miner right now.
Yeah, I keep looking at your BitAx. I'm trying to get it to mine while we're here.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody make sure. Now that we have like a full screen, everybody that's watching, just focus on this area of the screen.
So we'll take turns. When you're not looking, I'll look.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Clark's teeny weeny mempool. I know Odell lost the bet here, but that will live on forever. We got 9,258 transactions in Clark's mempool. And what's the last bit here? Samurai, is that right?
Well, we haven't done that bit since they got thrown.
All right. Well, you know what? It's been a little over a year now, so we'll bring it back just for the anniversary, and then you can not say it anymore. We got an unspent capacity of 7,757 BTC. Thank you for letting me do that. That was fun.
You crushed it.
Thank
you.
Did
better than Marty.
Good
job. Bravo.
That was incredible. Did I just get I couldn't tell if that was trolling or endearing.
I would think it was completely endearing. He did a great job.
I know you crushed
it. Clearly a ride or die freak. I mean, since Zach brought up Samurai, it's been a little over a year since they were charged by the DOJ. And Bitcoin Policy Institute is actually running their legal defense fund, which you can support at p2prights.org. So, I mean, highly relevant. Obviously, we have Zach here for Bitcoin Policy Institute. Thank you for all your work. You guys have been crushing it.
Zach, the Zap.stream live stream wants you to replace me. So you did a really good job.
Appreciate that. Happy to come back whenever. You know, I don't know. I don't know if it's worth kind of touching back on the news from the Samurai case last week. You know, I think there was an interesting article from Lola that came out, you know, sort of questioning the celebration that's happened. But, you know, I think broadly speaking, right, there is sort of positive momentum, you know, in that case. Even the possibility of that being reconsidered is really important. We are in the process of writing an amicus brief for that case. You know, Zach Shapiro has been working really hard on that. And so, you know, if we get the good news, you know, obviously that would be great. And if that's the case, we'll probably adapt that particular amicus brief to the Tornado Cash case, which has already had some bad case law come out of it. But if not, you know, there's still a ton of work to be done here. So, you know, want to echo what Odell has said. The work isn't done here. Your donations, you know, they're not going to go to waste. This will be an ongoing battle, but happy to see some light, hopefully, at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, very positive developments. And thank you for bringing that up, because I don't think the news had dropped between last week and this week, or dropped between last week's episode and this week's episode. But for anybody who's unaware, I believe the case is being discussed whether or not it should even go to trial right now.
Well, I think the Samurai lawyers want it dismissed, right? They asked for it to get dismissed.
Basically, I think what happened was there was a joint letter filed by the plaintiff's attorney and the Southern District of New York and Samurai, you know, the Samurai guys, their attorneys as well, that basically said, hey, we just received this letter from DOJ leadership that said we're gonna, basically end, I think that the term they were using was regulation by prosecution, which was a Biden administration sort of policy. And that letter, if you take that to heart, if you believe it sincerely, would necessarily mean that this case gets dropped. If that's actually the policy of the DOJ, then this case is sort of out of scope for them at this point. And so the letter to the court basically said, hey, the Southern District of New York needs to evaluate this memo. We need some time to think about it. We're going to put the proceedings on hold until we can kind of figure out what this means and if we want to continue with the case. And so we should know pretty soon here what the resolution to that is. I think it was a 14-day hold. Not making any promises here, but it'll be really interesting to see what that looks like.
And we will keep you freaks abreast of the developments as we have for the last year as they come to market. Zach, thank you for joining us. Thank you for the work that you do. And as he mentioned, there is a Bitcoin Policy Institute summit in late June. So, Logan, link to it in the show notes. Don't forget, if you're interested in going, be there or be square. I'll be there. So, pumped to see you guys there.
Hell yeah. Thank you all for having me. This was fun.
Thanks, Zach.
See you later.
See you, sir.
See ya.
Ooh, this is fun. I like this, like, adding guests, like people cycling in. Are we evolving the show in real time? 355 episodes in? What's happening here, man?
You got to keep 7 years of marriage. You got to keep it fresh. That's boring.
Speaking of keeping it fresh, let's set this up. Matt mentioned earlier, Apple and Epic.
Mm-hmm. Epic Games. Fortnite creator.
have been in a big legal battle for many years now. And there's been a resolution. I wanted to bring you in to talk about this because you have some experience in this world. Yeah. You worked for Apple.
So. I did. Yeah. Spent 6 years at Apple working on privacy, AI, ML stuff, but also distributing a lot of apps. And I got into building apps before the App Store even launched. So I did a stint at Apple previously, prior to my 6 years, and helped kind of work on some of the SDKs for the original App Store. But then I went and did some startups and built apps. So I've got a lot of experience as a third-party developer as well as internally. To summarize the whole thing, what happened here is in 2020, Epic Games decided that Apple and Google both had a monopoly on app stores, and they've been taking 30% cut of all revenue that happens inside of apps, which a lot of people don't even realize, right? They just pay it. They don't realize that they're like paying a 30% tax to use apps on their phone. So Epic Games decided to challenge that, and they created this whole coordinated attack, basically, where they have their V-Bucks inside of Fortnite. And they were paying Apple 30% every time somebody bought V-Bucks. And so they just linked out to their own payments platform. And they put in the app, you get 20% savings if you buy through us rather than through Apple. And they knew that they were going to get kicked off the App Store. Sure enough, like 3 hours later, Apple booted them off the App Store. And it started this whole thing. They had a legal battle ready to go right after that. So they filed against Apple. And in 2021, a judge ruled kind of in both of their favors. So a judge ruled that Apple was not anti-competitive, was not a monopoly, but they also ruled in Epic's favor and said Apple needs to let people link out of apps for payment services. So that was 2021, 4 years ago. And just like a couple days ago, Apple is finally complying with that. So it took them 4 years basically to get around to it.
Yeah. And one detail clarification there. So app developers were passing that 30% tax cost onto consumers.
More or less, yeah. So in the beginning, Apple didn't let them do this. Apple used to say, if you have, like, let's say your Netflix, for example, you have to have the same prices on your website that you do in the App Store. You cannot mark them up 30%. So that meant that app developers were taking a 30% haircut. finally, I think Spotify kind of pushed the boundaries and got them to change their policy. So in the app is 30% more. So users are, they're basically asking users to pay 30% more if they use the app to buy.
Yeah. And so, this is pretty big.
This is big. This is a major deal. What ended up happening is like Apple decided to comply, quote, a year ago by allowing users to, or developers to put one link in their app that links out to a payment service. But then Apple also put all these warnings around it that's like, oh, you might be going to an external site. Maybe it's not as trustworthy. They tried to kind of scare people. This is according to all the, you know, the public articles, right? But then the judge 2 days ago said, you have not complied enough and you're still taking money from people. When they use those links, Apple was still taking a percentage cut of all money that came through those links. So she finally said, I've had enough. You must comply, and made it very specific. Like, you can't put up warnings. You have to let developers put links wherever they want to. Basically, stop trying to be anti-competitive, anti-steering, that kind of stuff. So,
yeah. This is pretty big for Bitcoin as well, correct?
Yeah, I mean, Bitcoin is another way to pay for things, right? Another payment rail. And so up until this point, you had to use the payment rails within Apple's ecosystem. But now apps can link out to other services. So whether that be Stripe, Zaprite, Bitcoin, just native things, whatever you want to do, Lightning, Liquid. I mean, there's all sorts of things that you could start doing.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. And I think about it from a Nostr standpoint and Zaps. You know, Domus is famous for like not being able to have Zaps in their app because Apple said that people were buying, quote, digital content with a Zap. And so was chatting with Will yesterday on Nostr, and we were kind of brainstorming like how could this affect that? And I think that there's a way that Zaps in Nostr are now going to be a lot easier to do, but there might need to be some trial and error still as they figure it out.
Matt, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, first off, we got two 21,000 Sats apps, and they both say the same thing. Odell, are you going to Kaysen and Kiwi's Hobo Barbecue? Which I don't know what that is, so no. but thank you for your support. I mean, for some context here, right? Like, people think, oh, it only hurts the little guys. Even a company as big as Amazon is, you know, one of the largest companies in the world. If you try, and historically, if you tried to buy a Kindle book in the Kindle app on Apple on an iOS device, you couldn't buy it in the app. You also couldn't buy it in the Amazon app. You had to go to Amazon.com and Safari and then buy it and then click load or whatever. So, I think this has massive implications for developers of all sizes. Obviously, it's insane how much control Apple has over their ecosystem, and it's good to see some of that control leave. I love that Epic actually fought the fight, and they fought it in a big way. Like, people don't realize, I mean, like, so Amazon did that workaround, right, instead of fighting. X, for instance, has his own workaround. Like, if you subscribe to the blue check on the computer, you pay 30% less. But if you do it in the app, you don't realize, because he could get banned for telling you that it's more expensive. So he would just charge you more if you did it in the app and just kind of rolled over. But Epic actually fought this thing, and they did it at great detriment to themselves. They not only pulled from iOS, they also you couldn't install, even though the same limitation didn't exist on desktop, they forbid Fortnite. They stopped releasing Fortnite for Mac. And they just said, if you have a Mac, you can't play Fortnite now, even though it had nothing to do with the payment thing. It was just part of their war on Apple. So, I mean, a huge shout out to Epic for making this happen.
Well, and Epic makes the Unreal Engine, and Apple almost came after Unreal as well. Like, they were ready to go full scorched earth, and Epic was willing to, like, take on that battle. Thankfully, they didn't come to that.
I mean, I think that's pretty fucking awesome. And then on the Nostr Zap side, I mean, I think a Nostr app without Zaps is just shit. Like, I want to see all the Nostr apps have Zaps in them. So if this means that we'll get that across both Apple and Android, then that's phenomenal. I think a new user joining Nostr should be able to almost immediately receive Zaps and send Zaps, and it should be done in as frictionless a way as possible. So really great to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, trying to frame this in a way that doesn't put you in an awkward position to talk bad about your former employer, but why did Apple cling so hard to this particularly? Is it, I mean, Apple in the Tim Cook era has been, many people claim that they're not as innovative as they were when Steve Jobs was still alive and at the helm. Like, is there some sort of, we're not innovating, so we need to hang on to this 30% tax?
Yeah, I mean, it's no secret that Tim Cook is a very different mindset than Steve Jobs when it comes to approaching business. You look at the revenue, you look at the performance of the company from a financial standpoint, the stock price, like between Steve Jobs and Tim Cook, it's night and day. Like the company just exploded in growth financially when Tim Cook took over. So I think that he just has a more operational and financial approach to everything. When this whole App Store thing started and the whole 30% started, this is, you Zoomers might not have been around for this, but in 2008, when the App Store launched, they said, hey, we're going to take a 30% cut because we need this to cover the costs of running the App Store and the developer platform. That's how Steve pitched it. But then it changed a little bit later to, well, you know, we're helping bring users, give you revenue. We're helping make a sale. So we want a 30% commission, right? Which 30% is like a high commission. I don't know about you. Well, I mean, real estate agents get shit on all the time for having a 3% commission, and Apple's collecting 30. Google does this, by the way, too. This isn't just Apple. Google is doing the same thing with the Play Store. They work together. But so I think that's really what it is. And I don't think that they wanted to give that up. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they make bank. But the key difference with Google is you can always just sideload an APK. So Epic is actually a perfect example here. Epic pulled out of the Google Play Store during all of this, and they educated their users how to install an APK so that they could run Fortnite on Android devices without paying the Google tax. And the key difference here is Apple has you locked in, so you can't install an alternative store. You can't install an app outside of the App Store. So they have you hostage where they can charge whatever they want to charge.
Yeah, definitely. No, that is a big key differentiator. Now, the majority of users don't sideload APKs, but you can. And it's nice having that off-ramp if you want to do that.
Well, I mean, to blow more smoke up of Epic's ass, I think a lot of Zoomers learned how to install APKs because Epic made it the only way you could install Fortnite.
Yeah.
There's probably, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that the first time they ever installed an APK was for Fortnite.
Yeah. Yep. Which we used to install software all the time on our computers. You would go onto some website and download a cracked version of Adobe Photoshop or something and throw it on your computer and just hope for the best.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful that spirit is coming back.
In the early days of this podcast, we had cracked versions of Adobe Premiere. We didn't have enough money.
Nice. Yeah.
To pay for it. But tying the knot on this, good for Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. People developing on Bitcoin or companies want to accept Bitcoin.
Right. I don't see how this can be bad for it if you're allowing people to link out now. I mean, in the Kindle example, it's a horrible user experience where Amazon does all the work to make a sale on that ebook, right? They like pitch you the ebook, their AI suggests things, they have ratings, and then you get to the point where you have to buy, and they couldn't even say, hey, go to our website to buy. They would just say, it's not available in the app to buy this. And like, it's a horrible user experience. So that's an improvement. But then also, it's not just app devs, it's like everyday content creators like you guys here. Patreon and some of the other platforms are also relaunching their apps and updating their apps so that they can link out to other payment services. And they're going to give they're going to charge less. So that 30% cut that was going to Apple now is going back to the content creators. So people on Patreon, if you sign up or Ghost or presumably any of these other places, we now have like tens of thousands of small businesses all over the world that are getting 30% more revenue in their pockets. And now they can hire more Logans, right? They can hire more people.
I don't recommend it.
Yeah. They can hire more people. So what I posted yesterday online is like, I think that this judge, you know, with just one stroke of the pen might have created more jobs than like any of our recent US presidents.
Really?
Just by giving 30% back to all these content creators, app developers, tons of small businesses everywhere are getting a boost in revenue.
How's Apple stock reacting to this? Because that boost in revenue for those businesses.
Yeah, they had an earnings call yesterday, so it's hard to know what impact this is having on their stock.
They're down almost 4% today, and NASDAQ, S&P are both up more than 1%. So
okay.
Maybe that's the market reacting to that.
They reported a record quarter yesterday, too.
Yeah.
So they should have had positive performance there.
Yeah, forward looking markets now saying that revenue is probably going to get cut.
Yeah,
the knees,
all the tariffs.
Yeah, Matt, I gotta apologize. I've not looked at the list yet. We're just riffing here. Another big topic. You and Anthony were at the Llama Conference.
Yeah,
how was that?
Yeah, it was good. They packed all of their content into one day. They said they can only get Zuck for one day. So, and I appreciated that. I don't like it when conferences drag on. So it was just one action-packed day. We got to sit in the room with Zuck. We were like on the fifth row or something. It was a little unnerving when he's like talking about how people can only maintain three friendships in their life. And so AI is going to supplement the rest of those friendships. And so we're going to start having AI friends because we apparently are too lazy to have more than three friends in our physical life.
Maybe he's just speaking for himself there.
Maybe, yeah.
Very awkward.
Yeah, I don't know. But no, it was good. They spent a bunch of money on it. They made it look really nice. But it was great because we were part of like a startup cohort, if you will. So they're going to be launching a startup program soon. And so hopefully with Maple AI, we're able to be like on the forefront with them and get free compute credits and stuff.
Yeah, you weren't here the other day, but Anthony came in and we were talking about like your discussions on behalf of Open Secret with other people. And it seems like people in the AI world have no idea about the ability to do what you guys are doing.
Yeah, nobody knows about secure enclaves or privacy. In fact, one other founder, we were chatting and he was like pushing back a lot, like right from the bat or right from the get-go, he was like just trying to push back on my claims. And he's like, oh yeah, but ChatGPT has the ZDR, which is zero data retention policy. So if you're a big business and you sign up, they say, yeah, we won't retain any of your data. And I was like, that's just a business promise, right? That's just on paper. We're not going to record your data. You have no way to verify that OpenAI is not keeping your data. And if there's a hack, maybe your data gets spilled, that kind of stuff. And he's like, whoa, I never really thought about that. So secure enclaves, man, you can verify the code yourself. You can audit it. You know, you can verify what's running in the cloud. It's the way to go, and nobody really knows about it. Like, we were even educating the Meta developers. We were hanging out with them at lunch, kind of explaining what confidential computing is to them. So,
you think you flicked any light bulbs off?
I think we did. Yeah, the marketing guy there was like, "Send me some write ups. I wanna kind of riff on this with our marketing team and see what we can do."
Oh yeah.
So hopefully we can get the word out there.
Well, how would you describe Llama's position in the model competition?
I think that they are always playing catch up. They'll probably always be playing catch up because there's a lot more money going in from these other closed systems. Facebook has a ton of money to spend. Meta does have a lot of money to spend. But I don't know. It just always feels like they're just a step or two behind. Even the claims that they made with Llama 4 turned out maybe they were making those claims on a private version of the model that wasn't released to the public. But it's still a great model. And we use it for ours right now. We want to get some other open source models going as well. Yeah. But I think they're always going to be slightly a step behind.
Oh, yeah. Matt, I see you want to interrupt us. Interrupt us. You don't need a zap. What's going on over there?
Dude, I'm playing the game. The guy only zapped 21 sats too. I only interrupt if it's a 21,000 sats or more, guys. Get with the program here.
Yeah.
People
don't want to hear about AI. This is a Freedom Tech podcast.
Well, open source AI is Freedom Tech.
Yeah. So, Marks, my question for you, Marty gets really locked in when he has a guest in the studio and forgets that I exist.
Hey, you do the same thing.
Guilty. My question for you, Marks, is so you guys have Open Secret, and then as almost like an MVP test product of what Open Secret's capable of, you have Maple AI, which is built on top of the Open Secret stack. And Maple AI, the goal of Maple AI is to be, you know, a privacy sovereignty focused chatbot competitor to like the ChatGPTs and the Groks of the world. Right now, if you use both, it feels like a worse experience. You know, it feels like you're making a sacrifice so that you can have privacy and sovereignty. Do you think that will always be the case? Like the cucked models, the models that surveil you and run server side and hoover up all this data, will those always put people at an advantage if they use those over the privacy freedom versions?
Because of what we can do with secure enclaves, I think prior to this, I would say, yes, they're always going to be at a disadvantage because user experience is harder when you're doing private encryption. But with secure enclaves, we can make the login experience the same as a ChatGPT. You can log in with Google, log in with email, log in with whatever you want to. And so now it simply is just comes down to a funding problem, right? Where like OpenAI has gobs of money that we don't have. And so they're able to build a better chat experience. And that's just kind of what we're running into. So I think if we had the same funding that ChatGPT had, we could have a comparable product. We could do awesome image generation. We could do awesome video generation. The chat experience would be the same. We would have web search that's done in a private way. We would have better, you know, document upload kind of stuff. Like that's all coming. We're building these things, but it takes time because we're a small team. So I think what you just described is not inherent to being private and having a good privacy solution. I think it's just inherent to us being a small company going up against a juggernaut.
Put your money where your mouth is, freaks, or where you would like to see the world go.
Yeah, start zapping 21,000 sats to this guy right here. Just kidding. Go to trymaple.ai. Check it out. That's how you can help.
It's we've been talking about this a lot. It's crazy how good these things. I was showing Matt earlier this week, like the AI meetup that we had here at the park last week that I participated in. Like Sahil was like demoing his use of Super Whisper, and I downloaded it. It's completely changed my life. It made me more productive. And you're telling me, like with Maple, like you have voice to text, and you're just like having conversations back and forth to set up your day.
Yeah. In fact, I was driving into work this morning, and I just hit the microphone button and was like, "All right, I want to make sure I understand everything between Epic Games and Apple." And so I was just having a back and forth with Maple on the court case and everything using my microphone because I'm driving. So
yeah.
It's awesome being able to use that.
Yeah. You guys are crushing it. Thank you for coming on and educating us about Epic, Apple, Llama.
Sure.
Open Secret, Maple.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure. Anything we should leave the freaks with?
I would just say that I was in this headspace for a while too. Don't tune out all the AI talk. I'm sorry that we're on here talking about AI on a Bitcoin and Freedom Tech podcast. But it seems like AI is like here to stay, and it's worming its way into everything. So if you're someone who just like immediately tunes out and gets sick of all these podcasts talking about it, like maybe tune in just a little bit and start playing with it.
And you have a new show. You want to shill your new show?
Sure. Yeah. I was streaming it right before this. It's called Freedom Tech Weekend. It's one tool that you can play with this weekend to try and decouple yourself from commercial products that lock your data in. So we covered Bitwarden today on Freedom Tech Weekend. Last week we did the Orion web browser by Coggy. The guys at Coggy are awesome. I stream on all the platforms, and then I make it available afterwards as a podcast as well. So you can go check out Freedom Tech Weekend in your favorite podcast apps.
Hey, he's already shown it right.
Right. That's like cool. And subscribe on YouTube, X. I got to get Zap.stream working though. I haven't got that yet. I got to figure that out. But
damn, get your shit together.
That's right. Every Friday, 15:30 UTC.
15:30 UTC. Oh, wow. That's a true freedom. He's got it. That's right there.
Yep.
Locked in.
Marks, yeah. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Thanks, guys.
I'll see you out there when this is done.
Okay. Peace.
Thanks, Marks. Appreciate you.
All right. I'm going to look at the list. What do we got here?
The next thing I got on the list is Fold rings the NASDAQ.
Oh, hell yeah.
All right. New Zoomer.
Feels like
Logan, feels what are you like coming in for?
Deal. All right, it's time. New Zoomer. No.
you're welcome to join.
Logan, you can join if you want to join.
Love you, Logan. Logan exists.
We're trying to replace him with AI, but it's not there yet. We gave up on the H-1B visa replacement. a kid. Fold, ringing the bell. Big day.
I thought it was, I mean, it's just cool seeing your friends ringing the opening bell.
Yeah.
So that's why I put it on the list.
It's friends, partners. It's a big day.
it's everybody like ringing the bell. I've never done it, but everybody looks extremely happy when you're doing it. It has to be a cool experience.
Yeah, do you think they tell you like smile, be happy?
They have to. I imagine they do.
But anyway, Jonathan from our team at 1031 was there with Will, a huge smile on his face, ringing in the bell. Love to see it. On that note, there was a conspiracy running wild on X this week.
We're
going to
talk about it?
Yeah, we're going to briefly comment on it. I think there's nothing to hide here. Calling 1031 scammers and linking to a document implying that we dumped a bunch of Fold stock on retail. 1031 has not sold any Fold stock, and the document linked was a credit deal we helped coordinate for Fold to bring in 475 Bitcoin onto their treasury. So that's what happened.
Example
there.
Of us increasing our exposure.
Yeah, I will never tell you to go buy stocks, freaks. Never have, never will. I think most people should just stay humble and stack sats. But we're very happy to help facilitate the needs of our founders as they try and grow their businesses.
I think you put it perfectly. That was one I was just going to complete. I mean, it was just so off. It was funny how it was being portrayed, and it's actually the exact opposite. But there's a lot of people out there. If you're out there and you're just like you're just shitting on everything and trying to be the purest of the pure, touch grass. I'm a big touch grass guy. Also, hold us accountable. Hold us accountable. We like to hold ourselves accountable.
Yeah, but it goes both ways. Like, if you were mistaken and you made a mistake, and that it was clarified that you made a mistake, don't just ignore the fact that you made a mistake. You should probably own up to that.
Yeah. Accountability. Hey, I held my hand up earlier. I made a mistake of assuming that a whole generation was a certain way. I've been proven wrong by our Zoomers. This has been a fun rip. I like this format.
I mean, it's not really a format. It's more just like organized chaos. Marty told me Marx was joining. He didn't tell me Ben was joining until
I didn't know Ben. I walked in 5 minutes before we hit record, and I saw Ben sitting at the desk, and I did look at the list when you sent it originally. I was like, op return first. I was like, Ben, you can talk about this. You want to join us? And he happily obliged.
Next thing I have on the list is the Bitcoin DevKit Foundation announced new corporate members for 2025, including AnchorWatch, CleanSpark, and Proton Foundation. I think this is really good to see, and it's an interesting model that we've seen in the greater open source ecosystem, where these companies are leveraging BDK, the open source project, to build their infrastructure and their wallets. So they want to support back in a sustainable way.
Hell yeah. Great to see it.
And BDK Foundation was bootstrapped out of OpenSats and Spiral, and now they're independent, which is also cool to see.
One of the most important projects in the space. Shout out to everybody contributing to BDK. And any development kit for that matter, LDK, PageJoin development kit, PDK. We need these developer kits to make it easier for people to build applications on top of Bitcoin. Logan, before we get to the software update section, can you go to tftc.io and pull up the bent from this morning? Shout out, we had Zach on from Bitcoin Policy Institute. These guys are doing an incredible job. One of the great things they do, yeah, that one with Martin Luther King. I was a little cheeky with the bent. I have a dream. Part of the job that the gentlemen and ladies at the BPI are doing is highlighting where Bitcoiners are running into problems. And this is one I was unaware of until BPI wrote about it earlier this week, which is a problem that I've run into that I'm sure many other Bitcoiners have, which is if you want to go buy a house, it is hard, if not impossible, to use your Bitcoin to prove that you have a certain amount of assets that would enable
somebody issuing a mortgage, a bank or a mortgage broker to underwrite a loan to you. If you go to get a mortgage and you're like, hey, I have Bitcoin, I just sign a message to prove that I own this amount to contribute to my net worth to prove to you that I'm credit worthy to get this loan. They'll say, no, you have to sell that Bitcoin, move it to a bank account, have it sit there for a certain amount of time. And after that certain amount of time, that'll be recognized as assets that you actually own. And it's a big problem. You either sell your Bitcoin or take the risk of taking out a loan to get cash to put it in the bank account. It's just a very roundabout way to prove that you have a net worth that you know you do because you hold Bitcoin. And the BPI guys highlighted that this is due to something at Fannie Mae. So Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, they have these guidelines, and while they're not clear-cut regulations, they are essentially, it's like the FATF, it's like the Financial Action Task Force. If they put them out, people adopt them. And one of their guidelines is explaining exactly this. Like, we will not recognize quote-unquote virtual currencies as assets on an individual's balance sheet. And they basically describe, if you want to recognize that value, you have to sell, move the cash to a bank account, at which point it will be recognized as value. And so if we want to open up the ability for Bitcoiners to not have to sell or take out loans to get a mortgage, these guidelines need to be eliminated. And luckily for us, the current director of FHSA, which I believe is the regulatory body that looks over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, is a Bitcoiner, Bill Poult. So I think if this is unwound, it could be massively beneficial for Bitcoiners and their ability to actually get houses.
And there's a little bit more context to it. So in the U.S., we have 30-year fixed-rate mortgages as the norm, which is rare for the greater world. Most places do not have 30-year fixed-rate mortgages. And the reason we do is because it's effectively a government welfare program. No bank in their right mind would give you a 30-year fixed-rate loan to just some random schmuck to buy a house in a high inflation environment. But what happens is, as soon as the mortgage gets finalized, it then gets bought by the government through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So that's why they have so much influence, because they're the ones buying the bags. I think we probably shouldn't have that. I mean, it's a little bit out of my pay grade, but I think it's probably a net negative long-term for America that we are subsidizing these mortgages and kind of breaking the free market there in terms of house prices and mortgage risk. But
yeah,
that's my two sats.
I'll have to catch up with Parker on that. Parker did a deep dive into Fannie Mae's balance sheet at some point in the last couple of years. And if you look at it, it's not good. They have something like $7 trillion in, I think, exposure. Maybe underwater.
Yeah.
And if you remember,
they just like blindly buy the mortgage right after it happens.
Yeah.
I don't know how much analysis is really done there.
Yeah. But they were quasi private before 08, and then post 08, they were fully acquired by the government. Is that correct? I think that's how it happened.
I don't know. But I do have a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. And I went with the path where I just didn't disclose my Bitcoin ownership, even though it's the overwhelming majority of my assets. So I basically applied as an incredibly poor person, and they approved me when they probably shouldn't have approved me. I mean, in reality, I pay all my mortgage payments, and I'm a great person to lend to, but they didn't know that, and they did it anyway. So, yeah.
Beware, freaks. On to software updates. Primal version 2.2 on iOS and Android has been released. Big update.
Yeah, so this one's massive. We released a bunch of cool new things. The first thing is that we added Blossom integration, which is a protocol for distributed verifiable media. So when you upload a photo or video now on Primal, it complies with the Blossom spec. It is hashed and signed. So you know who uploaded it, signed by their public key, and then you can tell and verify that it hasn't been altered after the fact. So you can't do a deep fake of the video afterwards without it being obvious that it has been changed. And then this spec is cross-compatible with all Blossom servers. So you can actually set in the app to automatically mirror to a different Blossom server, your own Blossom server. You can run your own Blossom servers. And it's just a very efficient, interoperable way to do censorship-resistant media. So really great to see that. That's been in progress for a long time. Then we also added delete functionality, which is in Noster is a little bit interesting because it's a request delete. So it says request delete, you press request delete, and then it asks the relays, it asks all the relays to delete the event. But relays don't have to honor it. Most relays do, the large ones definitely do. Primal honors it, but you have no guarantee. But to be clear, that's the case with the entire internet. If you press delete on X, you have no guarantee that Elon's actually deleting the tweet in the back end. You just know that on the front end, you don't see it anymore. So with Noster, that's obvious, but that's always been the case throughout the internet. I think that was a big feature add that people wanted to see. Also, Primal added push notifications for the first time. And with that, push notifications can be seen as kind of predatory, but people love them because it hooks you in, it addicts you. So they're off by default. You can turn them on in settings, and there's a bunch of different options there on which push notifications you want to get. And then last but not least, on Android, there is a popular app called Amber. We talked about it last week. Mm-hmm. That holds your private key for you and then signs into apps, so you don't have to put your app, your private key into every Noster app you use. And now Primal has support for that on Android. We'd like to see support on iOS as that ecosystem grows. But yeah, more to come. Check it out. I think it was a pretty big update. More stable than ever. The goal with Primal is quite simple. Make an incredibly stable, performant Noster app that has feature parity with everything you'd expect from centralized social platforms. And then from there, innovate on top and add a bunch of capability that just does not exist in regular social media land.
Don't sleep on Noster. It's happening slowly. Actually faster than I expected, but it's beautiful to see. Shout out to the Primal team. Go download version 2.0.2.2 if you haven't already. Check it out. Next up, it's not 0.2, Primal version 2.2, excuse me. Cashew dev kit. Speaking of dev kits, version 0.9.1 has been released. Looking at this, doesn't look like anything too major there. Shout out to Time Since for making their first contribution in PR 720 to this project. Last but not least, LNBIG shares revenue numbers. For those who are unaware of LNBIG, right when the Lightning Network launched, there was an entity known as LNBIG that spun up a bunch of nodes with a ton of capacity. So they've been around for a while. And many people were wondering, like, who is it? Who's doing it? Who are they? I don't think we know, but
yeah, they're in Anon. And they're unique in that regard. Most of the large nodes on Lightning in terms of liquidity, in terms of the amount of Bitcoin locked up, are well-known corporate entities. LNBIG is not. They've become more active on Noster lately, which is really cool to see. And anyways, this post is talking about how much money they're making, which the TLDR is basically nothing. They have 300 Bitcoin locked up in capacity on the Lightning Network. And I think he said here that he's averaging about 500,000 sats in revenue a day.
I wouldn't say that's nothing.
I mean, for the amount of Bitcoin he has in hot wallets, Like, that's crazy.
Wait a second. Let me do this math here.
He has 300 Bitcoin online in hot wallets. And presumably he's an OG where, like, okay, if he loses that 300 Bitcoin, it's not his entire stack, I would hope. But for most of us, that's insane amount of money, 300 Bitcoin. What is that? That's like $30 million today. And he has that locked up and he makes 500,000 sats, which is $500 a day. So locking up $30 million to make $500 a day.
Yeah, that's
And he's not including the cost of on-chain opens and all the channel management he has to do, all the on-chain fees is not included in that calculation. So it's actually less than that.
It's a daily yield of like 0.01%. I was told that this is where the yield was going to come from, operating Lightning nodes.
I mean, to be clear, other nodes are charging higher fees than he is, including Async Phoenix, which is one of the largest nodes on the network. So we should appreciate his service that he is charging less for Lightning routing. But yeah, just be aware of something to be aware of. And
million sats million sats every 2 days. He's averaging like 1.5 Bitcoin a year. Adding to that, 300, yeah. It's an annualized rate of 0.5% yield on the Bitcoin held.
Yeah, he said 0.6%.
0.6, yeah.
But once again, not including on-chain fees.
Yeah.
Which could be substantial if fees go up. When fees are up, it could be substantial. And he's been doing it for a while. So I doubt all of his channels are, you know, low sats per byte.
That's the proudest I've been on air Marty Math in a while. I did that in my head, not realizing it was in the post that it's right in front of my face.
Yeah, it literally says it on the in the post.
This was fun. A lot of breath on this episode. Open with OpReturn, Bitcoin Core, talked a little Bitcoin policy, brought Marx in to talk about Apple, Epic, Llama.
AI. You're all over the place. True rabbit hole recap.
Yeah. A lot of rabbit holes out there. Got any big plans this weekend, sir?
No. Not that I want to share. Hanging out with family. Pretty excited. It'll be a good weekend. It's been a long week. It'll be a good weekend.
Yeah. It's.
How about you? You got anything you want to share with us about your weekend plans?
I'm gonna go a little early happy hour with one of the other dads from the boys' school. Excited for that. A little palling around. T-ball tomorrow. Nothing much. Light weekend. This is what, like, we got big week in Austin next week with Texas Energy Mining Summit. Pleb Lab is doing a vibe coding hackathon. We've got Bitcoin Plus Plus. So calm before the storm here in Austin, Texas.
Nice. Big week.
Try to get a workout into at some point. We'll see.
Oh, when are we doing RHR next week then?
You're going to be. Good question. I think Friday. I think it might be another Friday rep if that works for you.
Yeah, I can be flexible for you.
Thank you. Yeah, we're going to be Nifty asked me to run the live streaming desk at Bitcoin Plus Plus. So.
Oh, wow. Look at you.
I don't know. Nifty. Never done this before. I'm going to underpromise. It's going to be good.
You're going to be great.
It's going to be great. It's going to be great. Logan's freaking out. I was texting Logan last night like, oh, we have to do this live streaming desk. Like, what do we need? Typical Marty fashion. Last minute. Logan.
Oh, yeah. Like, Logan actually has to do the hard work. You're just the face in front of the camera.
Logan, how are you feeling about it right now?
It'll be something.
It'll be something.
It will be something. It will not be nothing.
No, I need something more confidence inducing there. Can we do this?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Nice.
This is actually call to action. If anybody's out there, Logan does need help. If anybody's in Austin with live stream production skills and is willing to lend a hand, we will pay in sats. hit us up. Logan, this is a manageable one-man producer show. I think what we're trying to do next week at Bitcoin Plus Plus may necessitate two more hands at least. All right. We're winning. A lot of drama out there. This episode today, I think, highlights how far we've come. We've got this drama at the protocol level. Heavy things going on in DC. Freedom Tech is winning. Corporations are being forced to level the playing field for the little man. It's interesting times. Interesting times.
Love your freaks. Stay humble, stack sets.
Peace and love. Okay.